Okay, everybody. It's getting harder and harder to get you back in here. And it seems to me that it's because you're having more and more interesting discussions around the coffee. Chocolate. Okay. Well, we need something to lure you back in, and of course, that is the fabulous program. I really am enjoying myself, and I enjoy seeing you discussing so intensely out there. But now we're back, 5 minutes late. That's your fault. And to the now it's the group discussion. Hello, everybody. We're here. We're starting. Group discussion, leaders of national innovation agencies, and Alistair Nolan, of course. Alistair will lead this. Thank you so much, Alistair.
Thank you very much, Morten. Just before we begin, let me just say that we would like to circulate the presentations to this group, to all of the attendees, and would do so as PDFs. But please, if you have any objection, you wouldn't like to see your presentation circulated as such, please inform Julie. Otherwise, we'll take this as consent. So the aim of this session then is to have representatives from a number of innovation agencies respond to think aloud about what they've heard, not just around AI, but around the full spectrum of technologies and initiatives and areas of experimentation that we've been reflecting on during this last day and a half, and what it means for their agencies to set out the relevant plans and activities that they have in the institutions they work with, and to consider opportunities for cross-agency collaboration. There's others in the audience here who also represent innovation agencies, but not speakers in this session, and so we welcome also a lively exchange with the floor. So we have four speakers here. Eva Kamara, who's the Manager of Innovation Policies Analysis at Innovation Norway. Robert Rudnitsky, who's the Associate Director for Policy at the Office of Advanced Manufacturing in the US National Institute for Standards and Technology. Anna Correa, who's with the Director General for Research at the European Commission. And Stefan Wischmann, who has worked for 10 years in basic and applied research at Fraunhofer, the Max Planck Institute, and the EPFL in Lausanne. We'll have two PowerPoints from Eva and from Robert, and then we'll all sit together and discuss as a group as per the format of the previous sessions. So please let me invite Eva initially. Thank you.
Thank you, Alistair. Well, thank you so much for having the opportunity to speak to you today. It's been a very, very broad for an innovation agency. You've been into research, you've been into public sector, public investments. I'm going to focus on innovation agencies and the role that we have in the national system. And we have a lot of innovation agencies in Norway, I would say. We have innovation agencies working on energy. We have the Research Council working closely with us on innovation. But I'm going to focus on the core business of Innovation Norway. So I'm going to say a few words about us before we start. And I would really like to take this opportunity to have input from you on how what you think that we should do differently in the years to come. But important for me to say is that we are an innovation agency, so we don't fund research. Our primary focus is commercialization, access to the market, growth, and development. And we have we've been given three targets from the government: more successful entrepreneurs, more enterprises with capacity for growth, so the scaling and the established industry that is investing in innovation activities, and clusters. And we deliver our services, I would say, within three fields. We have capital, we are a bank, we have a bank license, we have grants, loans, guarantees. We have a lot of competence services, and we have big investment in the industry clusters in Norway. So this is a very sort of generic portfolio of instruments. And I think I would introduce the whole topic of this event today, that we haven't really changed our instruments largely to fit the digital industry, but we have to change ourselves. But our our aim from the government is to keep, so far, very generic innovation instruments that should fit all industries, a very sort of bottom-up approach. I just want to say a few words about Norway, because we may be mostly known for this, a very sort of nature and resource-based economy, but we have some assets in addition to our natural resources, and that is that we have a very high level of trust, we have a high level of adaption and use of technology, we have a high level of higher education among the citizens, we're an equal country, and we're a sort of good at cooperating with the industry, between industry and public, and the labor force and the industrial corporations. And we have a very strong research base in many fields, so it's a very good standing point to the actually new reality that we've been facing. Because the head of the central bank, he made a speech 3 years ago that really sort of set a new direction for Norway, that we're going from a special or a pole position to restructuring our whole economy. And although the oil price has gone up the last year, this is very much still reality. We have 97% of Norwegian industry is SMEs, small SMEs. Not 250 employees, between 3 and 5 employees. And a lot of our export right now is within the oil industry and the value chains that they represent. And we need to get more of our industry able and willing to grow internationally. I don't know, I wasn't here yesterday morning when Paul Shafi made his speech, but earlier this autumn, there was a strategy put forward to the government called Digital 21. And they mapped all our industries, and then they mapped it towards all these base technologies and system technologies that we have. And they said that actually all of Norway's industries will need all of these technologies. And I don't think they assumed that from the beginning, but when they did the mapping, it's clear that this is really important for the whole Norwegian industry, also the SMEs. And when we look at our customers, I would share them into two sort of main boxes. We have the companies that are developing the enabling technologies, and then we have mostly small companies that are making use of enabling technologies to create more value for their customers, making new business models. So how do we meet those companies? I don't know. Yeah. So we have identified three things that is a challenge for the small digital companies and for us. And that is speed. There's a very high need for a public innovation agency that is able to turn around quickly and to meet the needs of the companies quickly. They don't want long, large programs running for where they're sort of forced into a 3-year research and innovation program. They want agile programs, sprints, and so on. And we are really trying to meet that customer need. We have we don't have any cutoffs. We don't have any sort of try to avoid too many set rules for the innovation projects. We try to keep it open and adapt to the customer's needs. Then there's risk. I mean, a lot of the companies, they don't have anything to show to the banks. And that's where we come in. But even as a public innovation agency, taking risk is hard. So to have enough access to risk capital and to have the skills within an innovation agency to actually invest in softer IP, it's challenging. And then both we and the customers share the need to actually find the first customer. And for us, it's more finding the new innovative companies and make them access a public innovation system. And we have a big international network of offices in 30 countries, and that's of course the main aim for these companies, to reach international markets and international customers. But the market orientation can be very low. It's still a very sort of technology focus, not a customer need focus. And to adapt to this new customers, we realized we have to take our own medicine. And doing that, we really try to be more customer-driven. We try to adapt to the needs of the customers, and we try to be data-driven ourselves. And implementing a whole digital strategy into Innovation Norway has clearly helped everyone working there understanding the digital companies better. And we're using, to a large and larger degree, big data, AI, and so ourselves when we make our decisions. So to our services, in addition to giving grants and loans and so on, we give a lot of competence, and that's maybe to be flexible and meet the customers physically, face to face, instead of being behind this wall of just a cut-off date. It's really important to us to actually have competence going along with the capital. And then we have started two programs in Norway lately trying to give the SMEs access to the digital competence that they need. One is called, it's really not a good Norwegian word for this, but it's a network through our clusters which have a lot of digital components that the SMEs say that they need. So the SMEs are connected to our national clusters and get access to digital competence that way. And we also have a catapult program that we, where Innovation Norway, the Research Council, and our infrastructure agency give access to the digital infrastructure that the SMEs need. And more importantly, we need capital for the scale of SMEs, the entrepreneurs. We have had an entrepreneurial boom in Norway lately, but to make them scale is really hard. And this company, No Isolation, I think it's a good example. They've been getting capital from a lot of public institutions before they managed to match it with private capital, and they've also taken advantage of the capital that is available in Europe through the then Horizon 2020 program. And I think risk sharing with the European level is really key for all national innovation agencies in the future, because as a small open economy, we cannot do this alone. And we're working to a larger and larger extent with the public sector, putting up a big public sector program, especially focusing on the digitalization of the public sector and the access for Norwegian companies to deliver the solutions to the public sector. I think I've already used my time. This is just back to the trust that I started with, the high level of trust. I think Norway has certain advantages when it comes to testing out legislation. This is an example from autonomous shipping, where we have test beds in Trondheim and also here in Eastern Norway. And we have a sort of pretty high level of trust, making us able to take some chances testing out new technology. That is a clear advantage for Norway. And we have to be more forward-looking, being an innovation agency, and we have been trying to be more experimental in also in our work on evidence base. We started introducing randomized controlled trials and being more rapid also in changing along the way. And then I just have a few topics for discussion that we can take later. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Robert, please.
Thank you. So thank you. And first I wanted to thank Dominique and Alistair from the OECD for inviting me, and also Julie for organizing this and hosting us here. A lot of what I've heard in the last few days have been a mixture of hope and a touch of despair. And and I guess I should say my background is not in digital technology, so I come at this from a technology point of view as an outsider, and I want to encourage you to drop the despair. And I say that because being in this room the last day and a half, I've had the sense that there's something very exciting happening here in this field and even in this room. And I say this because when I listen to our national leaders, I often hear things that sound somewhat divisive. They speak about taxes and redistribution, they speak about trade, and sometimes, unfortunately, they speak about war. And I'm not speaking about any one particular country, but I think that this is a phenomenon that often is happening in our countries, which I think share values across the OECD countries. And when I listen to this group and when I've gone in the past to OECD meetings, I hear something very different. And what I'm hearing is, to give some examples, when I hear that the problems expressed by a chemist from Oxford sound a lot like the problems expressed by a machine learning expert from Leiden, or when I hear about someone talking about STEM from New Rochelle University, and it sounds a lot like what I'm hearing from someone from France. When I hear about the extraordinary work in swarm intelligence, and it sounds so much like what I heard just a little while later from a professor who I couldn't figure out if she was from NYU or Harvard, but I know that she's originally from Catalonia. As I hear this and I hear the great work that's going on in AI and it seems in blockchain too, my sense is that something extraordinary is happening. And while our leaders are not talking about blockchain and AI, I believe what I'm hearing today is that 20 years from now, people will look back and say, these are the things that were actually important. With that, my name's Robert Rudnitsky. I'm from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I'm going to talk a little bit about NIST, a bit about Manufacturing USA, which is a program I work closely with. And I have more slides than I have time, but that's by design because I knew you were going to be distributing my slides and I thought you'd be able to use them as a reference. Okay, that didn't quite work out as planned. Okay, thank you.
Just the green one.
Okay, now? Great, thank you. So NIST is the standards agency for the United States. It focuses on measurement science, and it has approximately 3,000 employees and another 3,000 associates working largely at two campuses. We have a budget of $1.2 billion, and our work on the laboratory side is split among five laboratories. Most of the work of interest to people in this room take place in our technology laboratory. In addition, we also have two user facilities. I personally worked at the nanoscience facility, which is part of the physical measurement laboratory. Inside of the technology laboratory, we have a number of areas of work that are potentially of interest on encryption standards, on cybersecurity for IT and Internet of Things, communication for first responders, and so forth. Inside of technology, there are a number of strategic priorities. Listening to the talk the last day and a half, I would say four of these are probably of greatest interest. Revolutionizing commerce with quantum science, connected, secure, and interoperable IoT, trusted data and analytics, and cybersecurity. In the area of quantum science, we're working to, and why? Just to be clear, we does not actually include me, to understand how to harness quantum-based technology for computing and telecommunications. In the area of interoperable IoT, we recognize that IoT is large, growing, and is an area of the future. And in particular, we're focusing on cybersecurity and connectivity. In trusted data and analytics, our areas of focus, and this is really an emerging area for NIST, are in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and then integrating that also into manufacturing. In cybersecurity, I'll come back to this now. In cybersecurity, we've developed the SP-800 guidance. SP is special publication, and this is a framework for working in cybersecurity. It has become the framework by which the U.S. government is working. It's been adopted most recently by the Department of Defense for all of their procurements. If you're not familiar with it, I strongly recommend that you download SP-800. It will be guiding cybersecurity, I believe, for the U.S. government and beyond. The area that I work with most closely is actually in our extramural programs, our Hollings Manufacturing Extension Partnership, which works with small and medium companies, and Manufacturing USA, which is similar to the Catapult programs that you've heard about, the Fraunhofer Institutes, and I guess for France, Carnot, and there are others in other countries. So Manufacturing USA grew out of the recognition that we had an investment gap in the U.S., sometimes called the Valley of Death. This is that there's heavy investment by government and universities in basic research and heavy investment in manufacturing and development by the private sector, but often ideas were not moving from basic research into the private sector. Manufacturing USA tries to bridge that gap, and it does this by forming institutes that bring together researchers with industry to work on problems selected by industry in order to advance in specific technology areas. There are 14 institutes in the Manufacturing USA network. My agency, my office, in fact, is responsible for coordinating the work of these 14 institutes, although we actually fund only one of them. The others are funded by the Department of Defense and Department of Energy. Of these 14 institutes, I believe three of them are of potential interest to people in this room, and I'll say this particular program is a very nationally focused program, and so the interactions with these institutes are probably best for the American participants in this room. Other programs going on at NIST in our labs are more internationally focused. I'll focus on one of them just as an example, the Digital Manufacturing and Design Institute in Chicago. It was funded by the Department of Defense. Like all of the Manufacturing USA institutes, it is a public-private partnership. It was funded with $70 million of public funds, matched by $110 million of private funds over a five-year period. And DMDII exists to advance digital manufacturing. And they do this in a number of ways. First, by holding workshops and bringing people together. Second, they've created a factory floor where member companies and member universities can develop factory lines and test digital manufacturing concepts on those lines. And then finally, by projects that they support and that they nucleate through project calls. And these projects typically involve companies working with researchers. So for researchers interested in this kind of work, it's a good way to get your ideas out into the field. I'll skip that. It has a broad range of companies. These are some of the larger companies, as well as universities. They also have, and not particularly listed here, an extremely large number of small companies, reflecting the fact that in the U.S., 97% of manufacturers are small companies. And in addition to doing work on research, they also focus, as do all of our institutes, on STEM education and workforce training. And this is an area that our institutes have had tremendous success in. In the last year, across our entire network, we've seen a sevenfold increase in participation in our STEM programs. We're now up to just under 200,000 participants in our STEM education efforts. I'll skip over the overall impact. Suffice it to say that while it's a new program, it's a program that is, we believe, succeeding at its goals. It has the kind of distribution of participation that we were seeking when we were setting up the program. We're also having good matching of federal to non-federal funds. Last year, it was a one and a half to one distribution of non-federal to federal. Overall, in terms of five-year commitment, it's actually a two-to-one commitment, which is pretty good because our original design called for only a one-to-one commitment. Going back to this, we're as I said, we're up to just under 200,000 people participating in our STEM efforts. And one more thought on that before I close out. A number of you spoke about the need for working on the pipeline, and I would very much encourage you, as you're thinking about that, don't just think about the pipeline that focuses on people who are destined for PhDs. Focus on also on the people who are going to be the line workers working in the fields where you're working. This is something that we've done in the U.S. through this program, working very closely with our community colleges. Different countries in the OECD have different education systems, whether it's in different ways, but you don't have to just focus on the university-geared individuals to have a huge impact here. I'll stop, and I think we're going to have a good time for discussion.
Thanks very much, Robert. Thank you. Stefan and Anna, if you'd like to join us on the podium, please. Okay. Eva, please. So thank you very much. And I'll ask Anna and Stefan to make your initial comments, and then I'll go back to two broad questions about innovation agencies and whether they are being sufficiently experimental, and also some problems of diffusion of the technologies that we've been talking about over this day and a half, and then we'll open up to questions and comments from everyone in the room. So Anna, you first, please.
So good morning, everyone. I would also like to extend the thank you invitation from the OECD and the Oslo Met. It's always a pleasure to be in everything that is organized also by the OECD. It's always very insightful. So I work in DG Research Innovation of the European Commission in the unit of Economics and Reform Impact. So I'm the one that is least on the ground in terms of the topic, but still, of course, I think I can provide you a nice overview, even if, of course, we don't have per se an innovation agency, but we have some commonalities of innovation agencies' features, for instance, in the European Innovation Council, that I will explain a bit further, but I'm sure you have already heard of. So I think something that very interesting came from the discussions is that indeed this convergence of digital technologies with the physical and the biological spheres is really transforming our economies and our societies at an incredibly pace. So what this means is that governments also need to adapt to this. So the World Economic Forum even discusses this issue in the Fourth Industrial Revolution through this concept of agile governance. So this is a tricky situation, right? Because on the one hand, you don't want to stifle innovation, but on the other hand, you also need to provide some regulatory clarity and some important principles for innovation to flourish. So we are in this, in the middle of the situation, and there are a lot of trade-offs, so this is why it's also important to have some policy learning, some exchange of good practice, to be here in general. So I would perhaps start with the importance of strategic and direction setting with the drawback that it might also have some consequences for innovation. But strategic and direction setting matters because it sets a vision and it sets some clarity. So this also means that the innovator knows a bit what to expect from the future in terms of the instruments in place, in terms of where policy making is heading towards. For the next framework program, so for Horizon Europe, that capitalizes on the successes already of Horizon 2020, there will be also this partly this mission-oriented approach, and this mission-oriented approach really entails, on the one hand, this need to communicate the impact of research and innovation more clearly to citizens in order to mobilize them, but also the need to have targets for addressing the global challenges, the pressing challenges of our era. So we think that also by mobilizing everyone and communicating this in a more clear way with targets, it's possible to also somehow from this bottom-up approach and top-down to get to overall solutions for the grand challenges of our era. So what this means is that we also need to adapt our policy instruments to the missions that we will pursue and the impact we want to attain from that. And also increasingly this will be a cross-sectoral and cross-disciplinary world. So missions should build upon that. So we saw that AI can be the equivalent to the new electricity in the modern world. So this should be increasingly reflected in the missions. But it's also important to allow for policy experimentation. So Nesta from the UK, they have this study on the innovation agencies of the future, and they find that from their examples that maybe there's no successful model per se, but there are some features and some interesting features of innovation agencies that within their context, specific context, work. But we need more policy experimentation, we need more policy learning, and we also need more evaluation. So the problem is that sometimes at the national level, public budgets are constrained, and they are more like short term, so they have the pressure of delivering in the short term to finance this and that innovator. So this constrains a bit the room for experimentation. So, for instance, in Horizon 2020, what we already have was a call to incentivize poly-experimentation in innovation agencies in European member states. So this was really money dedicated for innovation agencies to have some randomized control trials, to test certain new instruments to get to certain results, and then assess the scalability potential of this throughout Europe. So we expect this to continue next framework program. So then the European Innovation Council. The European Innovation Council pilots, to be more accurate, it is how it is at this stage. So basically the idea was really to have under the same umbrella all these different instruments that perhaps before, for the innovator that perhaps before were a bit dispersed. So this also follows the recommendation from this high-level group of innovators, so really like accommodating the industry perspective, et cetera, that they found that there should be really this one single one-stop shop for the innovator, because sometimes there's a lot going on, but the perception is that there's so much that we don't know where to start from even. So what we have there now is really the SME instrument, which also includes startups for concept and feasibility projects, demonstration, testing, piloting and scaling grants, but we also have the fast track to innovation for the more mature and really groundbreaking innovations. So we have here the different stages. Also the something that was already existing, the future emerging technologies, the FET Open. And this is really for collaborative, cross-disciplinary work on the future and emerging technologies, as we were discussing, in this workshop. Then there's also the Horizon Prizes, and these Horizon Prizes are also cross-disciplinary. So, for instance, tech solutions for humanitarian issues, the most efficient batteries, et cetera, so these prizes, well, are important because they mobilize a set of different stakeholders. They have a clear mission, and they have considerable time spent to develop their solutions, and they seem to have been quite successful. But then it also seems that the role of innovation agencies, and somehow we also see this in the EIC, is expanding not just to funding allocation, but also to have mentoring, coaching, and networking. So the EIC also includes this more comprehensive approach as well. So finally, just some notes on, I think, the importance of having advice. I know that this sometimes may make the European Union functioning more bureaucratic, as we were discussing before, but we really think that expert groups are important to feed into their experience into policy making. So we have the high-level group of innovators, but also this Pascal Lamy report, the RISE group. So they are really important for our own direction setting. And we really think that it's important to have, especially for designing of innovation, all this multi-stakeholder approach from the funding side, from the innovator side, from the the policy-making side. So we're trying to have this multi-stakeholder approach. And finally, just to give you some examples on how regulations should be more adaptive. So the Commission, since its better regulation agenda, has made some assessments of certain instruments that have or policy and legislations that have been in place in certain sectors. And there are already some conclusions on this, so the ones that should be improved. And then finally, there's the innovation deals that, for instance, in the circular economy, that really listens to the innovator. So there was a call for innovators in the circular economy, the industry, all these different partners, to come to us and really say, okay, this is the obstacles we perceive. And then it's up to the Commission to see, okay, are these really, like, real obstacles, or is it actually sometimes a matter of perception, as in the Dutch Green Deals, that they found that most of the time it's a matter of perception. So maybe I went a bit...
That's fine. Thank you very much. Thank you, Anna. Stefan, please.
Flash, a brief quick to my background. So I worked over 10 years in research in different areas, applied research, basic research. And I changed about 6 years ago to the dark side, maybe here in the room. So I'm one of those middlemen that were attacked yesterday a little bit. So we are a private company, but we are these kind of middlemen because in Germany this is open to competition, which actually is an interesting concept because we are kind of a funding agency, but we are in competition with underfunding agencies, which also has an effect on price, for instance. So we discussed yesterday how much expenditure do we have on these kind of agencies. But I don't want to defend this too much. I want to summarize a few points about the German perspective, and then raise a few questions which I think might be interesting to discuss in this group. What I took from yesterday is one very important thing, that there are really good stories yesterday, and I will come back to that. I think it's crucially important that we develop more of these good stories, as we have heard yesterday, and I must say that was one of the days that was the most insightful for me for the last half year that I've seen on conferences and discussions. Back to Germany, because there was this discussion also, is there constraint in money? No, there is not. In Germany, we spend now around 3% of our GDP for R&D. That means we have the numbers just for 2015, 25 billion in funding from the public sector and 60 billion from the private sector in 1 year. That is more than all Horizon 2020 has on budget. So there's tons of money for R&D. The question is whether this is well allocated or not is a different question. We want to increase this to 3.5% by 2025. We are now starting introducing tax concession for companies so they have a bit more freedom to do R&D than they have now, which is mainly project-based. And in Germany, we have this big umbrella that is called the high-tech strategy, which was just published this summer. It's in general kind of a seven-year plan without concrete steps, but which defines the main goals. In there, you find right now it's 12 missions that we define. One of them is putting AI into practice, so not surprising. We are a bit slow with an AI strategy, but we will come up with that in December, so a bit later than China or Canada, but it will come. But we're already doing a lot in that direction. And we had this discussion about CLAIRE and these competence centers, so we do a lot in that. Alone in Berlin, we have the Einstein Center now, and we have the Weizenbaum Institute, so big names, as you can see. We have high ambitions. So the Einstein Center is a public-private partnership that has over 40 million of funding for the next 5 years. It's aimed to have new professorships that actually develop these technologies even further. The Weizenbaum Institute is completely different, that actually tries to investigate the societal challenges. So there we really discuss what is the legal, ethical implications, what does it mean for society, what can we do about democratizing these technologies, how can we participate in these technologies. So we try to distribute this a bit. We don't make one big hub, we try to distribute it a little bit. Also, what next year will coming is something that's very novel. I'm not so sure it's going to work, but we will see. We will found an agency for disruptive innovation, it's called, which has a role model a bit in what DARPA is doing in the US. We don't spend that much money on that. We put for now 1 billion euros into that for the next 10 years. And the idea is to really have individual innovation managers that also hired for a short period of time that try to bring go all the way from the idea to the market. And they also have the full power of just stopping projects or giving more money into this project, so they're very free to allocate their money. Whether this works or not is a bit questionable. So disruptive innovation, can you fund that? Can you make a plan for that? I'm not so sure, but I think it's a nice experiment to see what's happening. We're doing a lot of other things about open access, digital technologies, digitalization of education. Maybe one more example before I come to a few challenges and questions I would like to discuss here is what really was very successful, that's maybe an advice, is we founded over 20 regional competence centers by now, which are specifically designed for SMEs, that they can come there, they can get information about these new technologies, and they get connected to research institutions to solve their problems. And they also have a limited budget where they can say, okay, if you want to have just a study whether AI is applicable to you, because what you said before is completely correct, most companies have no understanding what AI actually means and how it relates to their problems. And that's exactly what part of these competence centers should establish. And it's very important that we have 20 of them, because they're in the region. We see it especially with MNEs. They're not coming to Berlin. They're not coming to Stuttgart or Munich to be conferences, to be informed. They go where they sit. You have to put it in the region. It's very important. So also there, a centralized hub, I would say, would not work. What are our main challenges? That is AI getting into practice. So we're trying that. We are really good in research in AI in Germany. We're really bad in putting that into practice. China is better, US is better, that's not surprising, but even UK is way better than Germany. That's kind of the standard which I think we should aim for in Germany. We have a huge problem for war of talents. We already had this discussion, and it's getting, from a funding agency perspective, we see this dramatically now. Before, we allocated money, and we have often problems that companies, they do these R&D projects, not because they need the money, but they want to have access to talent, right? They want to work with universities. It's the main reason why they do, so they don't use this money. It's really bad for a research agency or funding agency because you have to get rid of this money, and then you don't use it. And universities were always crying for, we need more money. But what's happening now in the last year, what I observe frequently, is that even universities don't manage to use all the money that they get in funding. And it's just simply because they don't have the personnel. And that is Fraunhofer Institutes, that is Max Planck Institutes, and it's universities. It's going to be a huge problem, and I think this will be increasing. So money is not the solution there. We have enough, we can put it in there, we just don't have the people to do the job. Mm-hmm. Now I would like to come back to my topic from which I took away from yesterday. We should be honest, right? I mean, scientists, they all get money from just people, right? They pay taxes, they get money from taxes, and you get it for free. You don't have to pay a single dollar or a single euro back, right? You get money from the public, they trust you to do projects, and you don't have to pay anything back. I think in UK there were some models where you use loans for research projects, but you get it for free. And so this idea yesterday, I like it, to make the processes slimmer and more effective. But you have to be, you need to be accounted for what you do. This is very important. You're using taxpayers' money, you need to be accounted. That's why we have this bureaucracy also on the European level, that it's transparent, that we, that the public has the right to know what do you do with this money. You cannot just give money away to researchers and say, this is a nice community, it's going to work. I have big trust in that it probably would work and there would be great outcomes, but it's just simply not how, how our countries and how our culture works. And what do scientists need to do to spend this money wisely? What have we learned yesterday? One of the most important presentations we had for me was this crowdfunding presentation. What I took from that is you don't get science done with this crowdfunding, right? If you see these amounts of money, $3,000 per project, that is ridiculous. You cannot do anything with this kind of money. What you can learn from that is what people had to do to communicate. They have to put a huge effort into that to make videos to explain to the general public what they're doing, why they're doing, and why it's important to fund it. That we can really learn from these projects. And I think this is important. We have to get better with that. And why is this so important? So scientists have to become better storytellers. And Morten, you a little bit discussed, we discussed it yesterday night already, and you discussed it a little bit before. We have another danger besides the war of talents right now that's going on in Europe, and that is on the political level. We have the European election that was also before the next year, and in all the countries in many countries of Europe, we see a very extreme right-wing movement right now. And what's going to happen first if they get into power? So in Germany, this is really worrying at the moment. They're going to cut your funding for science because it's ridiculous. They sit there, they will say, well, origin of life, that is a ridiculous topic. We need jobs, right? We need jobs in the factories. I cut this. They will cut this budget. And if you're not a good storyteller to say why you do that, then you will lose this money. And that is a big, big danger that we really don't discuss seriously enough. Mm. And Bruce, I'm very thankful yesterday, your night, your presentation, that was perfect for that. This is the public what they understand, right? You're in a hot spring, you're doing basic research, a region of life, somebody, I would say 95% of public says that is nonsense. Why should we put any money? But then you had a little sentence in your presentation yesterday that is crucially important. You said, well, if we solve that, then we have a weapon of mass destruction to fight viruses, to fight viral infections. But somebody, everyone understands, right? And we have to become better in telling these stories, saying why we do that, for which kind of purpose. So we really have to do that. That is crucially important. That was my most important message. Also, the Swarm AI presentation was very nice for that, showing how doctors work together to fight better breast cancer. That's what everyone can understand, right? It's very simple. And I don't accept this excuse that science is complex. Yes, it's complex. But I don't accept this excuse that it's too difficult to explain it in simple terms. We have to learn it and we have to do that. It's very important. Mm-hmm. Besides that, so AI for policy advice, since we're sitting here in this group. I think what we really need, there's a lot of funding in national levels. We need to share this information more brightly. And there also Germany has to learn a lot of the stuff we do. We spent billions of euros in also a lot of research in societal challenge and so on, and we publish it in German. This is ridiculous. We cannot do this nowadays anymore. And I think a lot of other countries in Europe do the same. They don't know that. We spend 1 billion euros in a program that strengthens the competencies in production, just alone for this program. Nobody knows about it because all the information, most of the information about this is available in German. And also the what the projects are doing. I think the European Commission has a very nice platform already. I think it can be improved. But you can find all the detailed information about the project. It doesn't exist on national levels, not as far as I know, or very rarely. So there we need to do more. Mm. And then more importantly, the topic that you raised is very important. We try to measure the impact of the programs that we're running. And I think we're doing this so far very poorly. Mm. And I think that we need to work between the countries. Can I give you an example how we usually do that in Germany? So we develop a technology program that takes around half to 1 year to define what is important, what should we fund. Here's $200 million, do something with it. That's also part of our job. That's also part of the 5-6% that are spent on these funding agencies. Then we make a call for applications. This runs for about half a year. Then projects get submitted, their projects, and then it takes around 1 year. We are really proud if it takes 9 months from submission to starting of the project, but usually it's 1 year. Then the projects run for 3 and 3.5 years. And then an evaluation starts when the program is finished. That takes around 1 year after that, until you have the report. So altogether, that takes 6 to 7 years from developing the program to evaluating it, to measure the impact. We can increase, we can make better indicators. There we should also exchange on the international level to have common indicators that we compare that. But that's just way too long. We're talking about here digital technologies. We have a lot of AI technology. It's way too long. It cannot be possible that it takes 6 to 7 years to say this program was a success or not. It's just incredible for me. And so we need to use also maybe AI or something, but most importantly, digital technology for that, because we are in a, when we talk about Industry 4.0 on the funding policy side, how we do the paperwork we do, we are Industry 3.0. We're not even at 4.0. We're really bad. We're discussing in Germany for over 10 years that we have digital folders for all the projects are running. Over 10 years, can you imagine that we're discussing that? We still don't have a standard for that. So how can you even use AI for policy measurements if you don't have digital standards for doing funding and of innovation and such things? I think I end with that. I'm really happy to discuss about it.
Just one question to you, Stefan, because you mentioned this last night, and if those ideas are still live, you had some thought regarding possible inter-agency collaboration?
Yeah, so this goes actually especially back to measuring the impact, because in Germany we also run evaluations for all the programs, and they're usually very different, because we give it as contracts. Different companies do these evaluations. They come up with their own indicators, which are really not well comparable, and I think it would be very beneficial if between countries, so you're working now in Germany, you'd have at least a basic set of common indicators how we can measure the success and impact of this program, what works well, what doesn't work well. So that would be one point where I would be really interested to talk about how we can manage to have in different countries, because I know in other countries on European levels, we also have evaluations of these programs to have there a better exchange, and there we need common indicators, so we should really talk about this. And the other thing is we have to exchange more about these experiments that are going on. I was very impressed about the talk about Singapore. I find this is a typical experiment. So we do 100 experiments, we give 250, and I would like to know how well does that work? And I think in different countries, in Germany we also start to have reality laboratories, we call that, we start it. And I think on that level we also need to find kind of a platform to exchange these ideas, because we cannot do it in all countries in parallel. We just don't have the means for that, and we have to allocate these resources. But we also have to be careful, can we really design good experiments, right? There's a lot of scientists. You talked about control groups. That is not that easy, because with drug development, it's easy, right? You give one person the drug, the other one not, and you forbid taking any other drug during that trial. So what does it mean for funding? So you give one group funding, the other one not, and you say during that next 3 years, you're not applied to apply to any other kind of funding. It's impossible, you cannot do that. So we have to find a way to design these experiments well, that we're not coming out with some measurements and say this was a success or not. So I think this is the two things where we should really work more closely together to just improve the speed of how we can change the programs and adapt to the need.
I have one observation question, but maybe if anybody on the panel would like to react to any of the points the other panelists have made, please feel free. Eva. And maybe, Eva, you could also tell us in that regard, you mentioned that Innovation Norway is beginning to use artificial intelligence in its own decision-making processes. Maybe you could just explain.
Well, I think it's... I use the term taking our own medicine, because we preach a lot from the government on what the industry should do and what they... that they have to adapt to this and that. And I think that from a public perspective, to start taking up the strategies ourselves is really important. And then you see also a lot about, we see a lot of the challenges that the digital industry has when it comes to data, when it comes to using data, when it comes to bad data. And we're really working hard to have a more data-driven decision-making system down to the individual person assessing the applications from the industry. And it's we're far from being sort of 100% data driven, but it's a process that we've started, and I think that also makes us better dialogue partners for the companies. I just wanted to comment on the evaluation. I think I totally agree. We should really work more across. Cross-country, and we have actually been part of one of your MLEs on evaluation, which was very useful. But what we struggle with is that we have a lot of individual program evaluations, and we do very little sort of meta-evaluations looking across all these different multiple programs and competence programs and grants and loans and so on. So we don't really see what works for what kind of customers in what phase and so on. That's one side of it where I think we could do a lot of international cooperation. The other side is the randomized controls, because it's also about being brave and being a little bit more experimental ourselves and also taking a little bit of risk, because that's actually a big part of it, being able to test a few things where we're not 100% sure whether this is going to work or not. And there I think it's a big, big cultural and change that is needed to happen in the public sector. Because being now in the phase of implementing RCTs in Innovation Norway, we meet a lot of resistance, I can assure you. And we have, through the IGL and our partners, we hear that from all innovation agencies, how hard it is to be more experimental. And that's really like a cultural change. And to the missions, because that's that was one of my questions, because at Innovation Norway, being working quite close to the market, we've had this very sort of, we're supposed to be industry neutral, not picking any sort of kind of sectors. All our instruments are supposed to be generic. But the whole mission, more combination of top-down and bottom-up, is something that maybe is being more and more discussed in Norway, especially on the research side, less so maybe on the innovation side. But I have a question to you, Anna, because we've seen the list of missions proposed now, and this whole public engagement, feeling that science and innovation is important for you as a citizen and paying your taxes to fund that. Then I want to ask you about the quantum computer, because I think the whole Mazzucato approach was to engage the citizen because it matters in their life, and that it shouldn't be a sort of technology push kind of mission, but a more sort of bringing together the citizens, the public, the industry, the regulations, the whole platform. So could you expand a little bit on why you chose that mission? Because that would be...
I don't think Anna chose it particularly.
The commission, No,
so I was not involved in the process, but what I know is that indeed it was a multi-stakeholder perspective. So I know that it had the industry, it had the citizens involved, it had the experts involved, the policymakers. So, I mean, also the member states' views, you know, that they had position papers and on how to design the next program, etc. So also I think there are certain, of course, like things, like areas where the EU is strong. So quantum research is one of them, but I don't know if it was related to that or not. Honestly, I don't know how it came to those per se. But I can put you in contact with my colleagues.
It's also to the audience, you know, if we want that public engagement, what kind of missions should we design to
Well, I know that it was quite diverse, of course, because even at the member states level, well, we even have smart specialization strategies, right? So, which reflect your own national context, etc. So, it's of course hard to get to missions that will please everyone. But I think that the outcome is also that you see yourself, the context of your country, etc., recognized somehow in the missions that then will further develop. Mm-hmm. But about that one in specific, I cannot comment further because I'm not saying
I'm against it. I just want to.
Because it's more specific than others.
Perhaps Robert.
Sure. So I guess I'll just comment on a couple of things. So first thing to say is I'm always hesitant to describe my own agency as an innovation agency, and I would even say I'm hesitant to describe any particular U.S. government agency as a start-to-finish innovation agency. We have agencies that fund basic science, like the National Science Foundation, the NIH, and others. My agency focuses on developing standards and developing test measurement capability to support commerce. And often that leads to innovative things. You know, you do have people who suddenly have these moments of saying, boy, I'm really sorry that I won that Nobel Prize. All I was trying to do was develop a measurement method. And we've had four or five, depending on how you count it, of those. But our goal is not to be leading innovation. The view of our agency, and I would say broadly of our government, is that innovation happens in the private sector. And so we help the private sector and we have a great relationship with the private sector because we stay in our lane. And when it comes to standards, if you look at my agency's webpage, the unofficial, we have an official mission, but our unofficial mission statement, which shows up on our webpage, opens up by saying NIST is a non-regulatory agency focusing on et cetera, et cetera. And to my knowledge, it's the only federal agency that starts out by saying what it is not. And it's an interesting thing. So, Alistair, to go to your question of, or your meta question of, are we doing enough in innovation, at least in the areas of AI and blockchain, from what I gained from this meeting is that the U.S. as a whole at the moment is doing well in these areas, but it's doing well because of the work of our companies. That's not to say we'll always be doing well, because now I'll roll the clock back to when I was in graduate school 22 years ago to a very particular conversation. And I'm referencing this, again, to give some hope to those of you in the room who are like, what do? We've got the U.S. This is for the Europeans in the room. We've got the U.S. on this side. We've got China on that side. And we're just going to get squeezed here. And so 22 years ago, I was sitting in a, I'll call it a dorm room. It was kind of a cabin, with a graduate student, and his name was Sergey Brin, and he was very excited about something. Now, the funny thing about it is, you would say, well, obviously, 22 years ago, it's 1996. He was excited about his work that he was doing on that led to Google about search engines. And on another occasion, yes, he was, just to be clear. But on this particular day, the thing that was exciting him was he had a new pasta machine. And he was making dinner for his friends. And he was showing us how the pasta machine worked. A few years later, I saw him at a coffee house. And he was thrilled that I had heard of his company. This is not so long ago. And right now, when you say Google, you think of a global behemoth that just dominates every sphere that it works in. The world changes quickly. And again, going back to 22 years ago, the decision I was making at that time was, should I sell my Mac? Because it was very clear to anyone at that moment, Apple was going to be dead within months, and I didn't want to be using a computer that was obsolete, and so I bought a PC. So the world changes very quickly, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm from the U.S. government. Obviously, my hopes are that these U.S.-based global behemoths continue to be U.S.-based global behemoths. But don't despair. The you know, Sergey and Larry 22 years ago were not envisioning a global behemoth. They were excited at every phase of their growth, and companies and individuals in your countries can do very much the same. Last comment, going to the question of standards for evaluating things. It may very well be a good idea. I do work for a standards agency. I will tell you, standards take a long time to develop, and what I gained from this meeting here is that things are moving very fast in these two technology areas. So by all means, pursue standards. Sometimes standards are hard because things develop in divergent ways in different places, but before you even get to standards, we've found enormous value for the programs that I work with in just outside evaluations, but real outside evaluations. You know, it's easy to contract with someone to do an evaluation and get the answer you want to hear. We found enormous value in bringing in outside evaluators to give us the answers we don't want to hear and push ourselves to get better in the programs that we work with. And at least in terms of collaboration that can happen, with the people in this room from the different places that they come from the different countries they come from, you have the seed group for that kind of outside of evaluation. Yeah. I'll stop there.
Thank you. So we'll go to 12:45, and let's just maybe open the floor if there's any observations or questions. Please, Johan.
And can I just interject that? So I know the story about Serge Brin as well, but in 1996, he was coming just out of working as a graduate student for an NSF grant, and right. That NSF grant was...
Well, he was still in 1996 when we had this conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, so you probably still... Okay, yeah. Fine. Yeah, because as I understand, it was awarded in 1994 by the Digital Library Initiative. Okay. So there's two points here, right? So essentially, these guys were funded by a Digital Library Initiative, which ostensibly tried to make information more accessible, but in the realm of libraries, and that's where sort of the headspace of most people in that day was at, and also at the NSF. But the second lesson there is then that gave them the impetus to develop a global behemoth, an internet search engine. And so I think there's two interesting lessons to be learned there. First of all, they got started with an NSF grant, with public money.
Yes.
And second, what they developed was not envisioned by the project that they... by the project plan that they applied for. So I just wanted to make that observation.
I think it's very good
how important these grants can sometimes be, even if they're not very significant, and how sort of the innovation happens within the research program itself, and sometimes deviates from the original project proposal.
Absolutely. I guess the distinction I would make there is that I would consider that to have been basic research funding, and the divergence happened there, and that was the distinction I was making in terms of innovation agencies versus science agencies.
Exactly. Yeah, Charles.
I actually have something that happened to us. We were, as you know, European citizen, but I did my grad school in the U.S. Started this company about 3 years ago. We were initially funded by DARPA, the Department of Defense, to do actually very basic science. So nothing military, nothing secret or anything, actually done open as part of the BRAIN initiative. And then we got funded by NSF, a program that everybody should know about and I think should be mirrored as far as we can, called iCORE, Innovation Corps. It's spreading like wildfire in the U.S. anyway. I think it even has a leg in Ireland now. And it was basically $50,000, no questions asked, to travel around and talk to customers. And so basically it was travel funding for talking to customers. And I talked to 350 customers in the span of something like 2 months. 2.5 months, which allowed us to develop a much better understanding of the market than anybody else and build a product that is now being deployed to, 60, 12, and $5 billion companies in the span of 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And it shows how little money you need at the beginning, as long as it's framed correctly. Fun fact from that grant is that we were both voted as most likely to fail. No, most likely to succeed, but least observant of the workflow, just to give you an idea. And so there needs to be a certain amount of flexibility in these programs. Sometimes there isn't. And so it kind of devil's in the details. Another program that I want to mention as well to a gentleman from Germany. Sorry, I forgot your name. So Cyber Fast Track was a program that was put together at DARPA to actually cut the time of approval for a very small grant. So we were talking about you can't do anything with $3,000, you can't do anything with low amounts. But if you shorten the amount of time that it takes to get that money, it's a completely different story. Mm-hmm. So they had 400 proposals and approved 101 proposals. It ran for 18 months, and the turnaround time, I think, was 48 hours.
Cool.
radically different approach, particularly well suited for cybersecurity and digital domains. I think that these kinds of programs are good examples and experiments to show things that may be more suited to this cyber domain. Mm. So, just two data points.
Any other observations, questions? Phil.
Hi. In the spirit of why we're here, I was just wondering if each of you could reflect on how much international collaboration you do and what sort of initiatives you have of ways you can work with other countries from your guys' perspectives.
So let's take these then as the concluding remarks. Maybe just a minute each, please. Maybe Stefan, if you don't mind going first.
Yeah, I mean, there's in Europe, there's a network, it's called TAFTI. It's a network of national funding agencies. I think it's not used very well, honestly, because there we need more exchange about what happens on the national levels. And I mean, informations like this are super valuable. And I think there's a lot of other examples also in Europe. We have good programs that run very well, where we maybe don't need an evaluation, say, okay, this we can just try, this is $10 million that we can spend, that would be fantastic. And we need to be more open, I think, what we don't do now. We have a lot of national funding, as I said before. We are very close with European collaborations there, because we say that is a EU project, national funded. If you're from Switzerland or Austria, okay, but otherwise it's getting difficult. And I think with AI and data economy, that just simply doesn't work anymore. The EU term, the digital single market, and if you really want to have that, then also these national initiatives need to be more open to European collaboration. Yeah.
Thank you. Robert, please.
Sure. So it's very much mixed where I work, depending on the program. So our laboratory programs have extensive international collaboration. At NIST, more than half of the researchers working at NIST are international researchers who come to work there for a period of time. For Manufacturing USA, the program that I highlighted, that program has very much a national focus. We have a lot of policy discussions with our counterparts from Catapult, from Fraunhofer, and our institutes have international companies, as long as they tip, the rules depending on which institute, but they have international companies provided that they have a U.S. manufacturing presence. And some of the institutes have a different way of looking at it, but most of them have some international presence, but overall U.S.-focused. Our manufacturing extension partnerships, which focus on reaching out to small companies, help those small companies grow, and a large part of that growth is through using the U.S. commercial service to reach internationally. So again, an international aspect. So really, it depends a lot on which part of my agency we're talking about. I left out the most obvious thing, our standards development. Obviously, standards development by its nature is international, and that's just completely international.
Yeah, so it's just very short. I think exchanges and like all these learning aspects should be accounted for. Also on the evaluation, we need to be also clever about how we design it, and also to think maybe beforehand before designing the project, what is the data that we will need in order to get to a good impact evaluation afterwards, because sometimes we think of it after and then we don't either have the counterfactual or other sort of data. And then also I think an interesting conclusion is from the last intervention that devil is really in the details. So I think more and more in designing instruments, it's true that, while we need to put, of course, a lot of money into the system for the scale-ups and et cetera, which is a weakness in the European context, it's true that sometimes with the small amounts, if you are clever about it, if you really tailor-made the instruments, or if you have some more tailor-made and some more generics, you can achieve still great things and provide a good starting point for companies or entrepreneurs that want to take the risk. So I take that as a lesson also for myself.
Please.
I think increasingly international cooperation, I mean, we're being a very, very small country, we really depend on learning from others, and we've gained a lot of knowledge working on with Nesta. We're also in a TAFTI working groups. But I have to say that more and more Brussels for us is becoming the hub where we meet other innovation agencies. We're part of the IGLO Innovation Agency Group. And there we try to pick up good experiences, things that have been tested out elsewhere. But I think we generally do that when we develop new areas, like public sector innovation. We've been working a lot internationally because it's been so hard to sort of find good good instruments, but maybe on the things that we've done forever, there we're not as good in looking outside our national system. So thanks for the tip on your instruments, because the market orientation and the internationalization is really the core bottlenecks for our companies.
Thank you all so much. I think with all of the topics we've discussed, we could go on much longer.
Yeah.
And I think that before we thank the discussants, I'll just mention that for lunch, we're going to be walking up the road a little bit. We're going to be ushering you to a pizza parlor. And so we'll meet outside in the lobby area, say, in the next 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll go as a group. But thank you very much to the discussants.
Thank you.